Check out my new book, Reach All Readers, at reachallreaders.com. When you pre-order, you'll get special access to my Science of Reading mini course. Learn more at reachallreaders.com. Hello, it's Anna Geiger from The Measured Mom, and today I spoke with Dr. Devin Kearns, an education researcher who studies reading disabilities, including dyslexia. He designs and tests reading interventions and works with teachers and schools to implement them. He's also written a number of articles about helping students learn to read longer words. And that's what we focus on today. We discuss syllable types and syllable division and what might be the best way to help students learn to read those longer words. Here we go. Welcome, Dr. Kearns.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're going to talk today about polysyllabic word reading, which is something you're known for. You've written quite a few articles about those that people often refer to when trying to figure out what's the best approach for teaching kids to read those longer words. But before we get into that, could you talk a little bit about how you got into education and what you're doing now?
Yeah, sure. So my sort of journey to education started with my youngest sister, who had a hard time learning to read when she was little. When she was 6 and I was 13, sometimes I would do the 20 minutes of reading homework, and she really hated it for obvious reasons. It was hard for her to do. And later it became clear that one of the reasons she didn't know how to read well was because she'd been given inadequate, insufficient reading instruction. Now, I didn't know that at the time, but her difficulty was part of what inspired me to become an educator. And so I taught then much later, of course, in the Los Angeles area public schools. And I was inspired through that because, the schools that I worked in were sort of low income schools. There was a lot of educational need, and I felt compelled to really help that. I kind of had a service orientation. And so I taught in the schools for 7 years. And my first couple of years, I had a really hard time teaching kids to read. And again, part of the reason was that I hadn't been given good advice about how to teach reading. And so my students didn't learn to read very well. And that was why I then actually took a part-time job in my spare time. I worked 3 days a week in the evenings on weekends with kids with reading disabilities. And I learned how to use scientific principles of reading, programs that had an evidence base. And I realized that the problem had not just been that I was a new teacher when my kids couldn't learn to read, but that I hadn't been given good advice. And so after that, the outcomes for my students were much better, basically because I knew what to do, because I had been given the right instruction. So those were the reasons then that I decided to become a higher educator. I wanted to help other teachers avoid the mistakes that I made. And I decided that the best way to do that would be to be a teacher educator. So that's how I ended up where I am. And along the way, I also started asking a lot of questions about the kinds of things that I did, that even though there were certain programs I used that had a strong evidence base, I sometimes wondered about certain parts of them and whether or not those pieces were effective. And I wondered about the, what things we were doing that might be optimally effective and what things could be even better. Because, as well as we're doing helping kids learn to read, there's always room for improvement. And there are a lot of kids who aren't getting better at reading fast enough. And so I've always been interested to think about how can we do more for kids more easily, make this process better. So that's how I ended up where I am today.
So if we go back a little bit, and you talked about how at first you didn't know how to teach reading, and then your reading teaching improved. Could you compare those two approaches? Like, what were you doing before you really learned? And then how did that change?
Yeah, so I did a lot of kind of exploration kind of activities. So, we would do things with like word sorts. So I would have a baggie of kind of slips of paper, whatever, and the kids would sort them into categories. And then I would ask them to kind of infer what the category was, and which took a lot of language, a lot of them explaining, trying to tell me what the pattern was, and them trying to, infer that pattern. And it didn't work very well. It also wasted a lot of time because, first of all, it wasted a lot of my time cutting those things up. And then when I didn't cut them up, the kids had to do it. And then, we even had little books the kids would paste them in. I can't even believe the amount of paper that we wasted having the kids cut these things up, put them in books. I mean, I feel like I helped the Elmer's Glue Company in, business, with all the glue that was wasted doing this. And basically, it was really inefficient. The kids didn't learn enough quickly enough. And so, and I did a lot of just sort of let's read books And I would ask the kids, you know, to figure out the word for themselves. And I would pause for a long time and let them think about it and encourage them, try to come up with books I thought were high interest and things like that. All of which seemed like a good idea because I'd been told that, like, those are the kind of things you do. Like, you focus on motivation, you focus on getting kids to think about the words and use various strategies. What I was not clear to me is that what you need to do is help kids focus on the letters and the words when they're trying to figure them out. Because mm-hmm. the letters have the answers, right? And mm-hmm. that's what I hadn't been told.
Yeah, that very similar to my experience. I definitely did a lot of word sorting. And it, again, it was like I was afraid to tell them what it was. Like I couldn't just directly tell them. They had to figure it out. That was the whole point. Yeah, and yes, we pasted them in notebooks as well. So yes, I know.
It's amazing. Just like, I mean, what if like a cultural phenomenon, like we didn't teach probably any close to the same place. And yet we did the exact same thing. Is that wild? It's just like,
yeah. Oh yeah. We must be about the same age. So when you think about, you say polysyllabic instead of multisyllabic. And so I use that in my questions that I'm preparing, but can you explain why, is there a reason why you choose that word?
Yeah, I went back and forth on this a lot. When I wrote my first big academic paper about long words, I've been doing a lot of academic reading about this. And if you look at the academic literature, it's like split down the middle, polysyllabic versus multisyllabic. And so the reason that I went with multisyllabic or polysyllabic was that the paper I wrote is my first big academic paper in a fancy journal. It was on polymorphemic words that were also polysyllabic. And so I was trying to figure out which word was I going to use. And I was like, well, if I'm using poly for morphemes, why am I not using poly for syllables? Because they're also both of Greek origin, and poly mm-hmm. is more frequently used with words of Greek origin. And so I thought from there, I'm just going to go with poly because it seems more consistent and about half the people do it. And so that's why I went with that. I know it was a weird decision because it did put me in the space of being the one who says that. You could always tell, like, I wrote it. It says poly, even if you're not. Although some people have started to say it now. But I don't really care, you know. Yeah. Sometimes I just say read log words just because it's easier and, you know, no one has to, you know, take a stand on which one is right. But I don't really care. It seemed internally consistent at the time.
Gotcha. You're often quoted when people are kind of debating what we should do with syllable types or syllable division. And you probably know that. Yeah. So can you tell us what, in your view, what syllable information is important for students to know?
Yeah. So first of all, kids have to know that words have syllables, and they need to know that syllables are anchored by a vowel, and in the case of reading, a vowel letter. So the idea, every syllable has at least one vowel. That term has been turned into by Rolando O'Connor, who's a researcher who studies reading, has done a lot of really successful intervention work in phonics. She calls it ishalab. Every syllable has at least one vowel. You just need to know the idea that every syllable has a vowel or multiple vowel letters, right? And so one of the things kids need to know is that if they're going to break a word into parts, every part, every syllable has to have a vowel. So that's the first thing. Second thing they need to know is how to determine the pronunciation of single letter vowels. So when you have A, E, I, or U, or Y by itself without another letter next to it, it's not a vowel team, it doesn't have an R after it, it's hard to know what to say because there are really three options, right? There's the long sound, the short sound, and then the reduced vowel, the schwa sound, right? And it's not easy to figure out which it is. And you need to know that there are three options. You definitely need to know the long and the short. I don't know of any program that has conclusively shown, or you say it's conclusively shown, that kids need to know the schwa sound per se. I'm not sure about that. What I do know is that if kids don't have a strategy for long and short, it's really hard to read words. And researchers who have studied reading interventions that have polysyllabic word strategies that involve long and short have been successful. What I add to that, kind of along the lines of syllable types, is the idea that if a vowel comes at the end of a word, it says the long sound. If a vowel is in the middle of a word or middle of a syllable, it says a short sound. That is the same idea as like open and closed syllables, right? Mm-hmm. And I've sort of concluded that we don't need to use the term open and closed because it's extra information that kids don't need. But they do need to know that you have, there's a reason that a vowel letter might be long or short. And so they can look at those and they can determine which one it might be. And then they do need to know that at the end of a word, if you have a final L-E, it says the O-L sound. So what people call the stable final syllable or consonant L-E, that's a very consistent pattern in English, like that the L-E says O-L at the end of a word. So that's helpful for them to know too. So those are things they definitely need to know about syllables.
One thing I've heard you say before is that in presentations that the one thing you want people to walk away with is not to use the open shut syllable house with the doors. Can you explain that a little bit about what your issue is with that?
Yeah. So the syllable house is a technique for helping kids remember the terminology of open and close and the sounds that go with open and close. Right. So for the uninitiated, the syllable house idea is that when the door to the syllable house is closed, the vowel is closed in and has to say the short sound. When the house is open, when the door is open, the vowels at the end of the syllable and can say its name, like sort of like go outside and say its name. I guess it's free to shout its name kind of thing. And so it says the long sound, right? That's the strategy. So the reason that I don't think that's a good idea is that it's a form of meta knowledge. It's also kind of like, I was describing this yesterday at a presentation, it's like double meta knowledge. So meta knowledge is knowledge about knowledge. What's really important to know about long words and about single letter vowels is that there's a predictable way to determine the pronunciation of the vowel, right? So, and that's the idea of open and close, is that you can determine the pronunciation is short when the vowel is in the middle or at the beginning, and it's long when it's at the end. And that's been given the term open and closed. But the terms open and closed aren't really necessary, right? It has a linguistic base. There is a reason that we use these terms, like open syllables, sort of they're called tense syllables. Like when the vowel's at the end, it's a tense sound, and it's related to linguistics. And when it's in the middle, it's a lax sound. And so there are terms in linguistics, open and close, that people use in association with the tense and lax distinction. But it isn't necessary for children to know that. I cannot think of a reason kids would need to actually know that they're called open and closed syllables, right? Except that, you know, you're trying to give them a way to remember that the vowel has the long sound or the short sound. That's the idea. So the question is, why do they need to know the term open to know it's long and closed to know it's short? That's meta-knowledge. That's extra stuff to know about the pattern that isn't actually necessary. So that's one thing, right? So in my judgment, it's adequate to say it's a long vowel syllable or a short vowel syllable, sure. Right? It has a long sound, it has a short sound. It doesn't need another name, right? Mm-hmm. And now, as an aside, I'll say, vowel team syllables or whatever, those are often also long vowel syllables, right? So it would just be like you'd have to kind of come up with that idea that if it's a single letter vowel, it's a long vowel syllable and so on. I say it only because I know skeptics will tell me that, you know, will tell you that I'm wrong because I don't know about this, right? I know a lot about syllables, and sometimes, you know, I have to say these things so people know I actually do know what I'm talking about. So that's one level of meta-knowledge, knowing open and close. Then there's a second level of meta-knowledge, the house itself. And the house itself is an extra form of knowledge, which is saying you have to understand this idea of this house. And the idea of understanding the house is to help you understand the terminology, open and close, which then allows you to remember the pronunciation of the vowel.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, it's like two layers of extra stuff that I think isn't necessary. And so I want to be clear, it's well-intentioned. Like, I don't think people are doing it just to make kids' lives difficult. Like, that's not what they're doing. People think, like, they need to know this stuff, right? They need to know this in order to help them understand open and close. And open and close are really important for understanding how to read long words. And to a large extent, I agree. But it just takes it so far that to a point it's not necessary.
So what would you say about, you know, the other syllable types? Like, are you in favor of teachers teaching, like, for example, long vowel patterns, and then having them read, you know, list of words with those long vowel patterns? But you would maybe say you don't need to teach them that these are vowel team syllables, just teach them to read words with those patterns. Would you say would agree with that?
Yep, that's exactly what I'd say.
Do you think it's useful for I know some people would say that there is no such thing as, like, Lynn Stone calls them zombies. Like, she says there really aren't the syllable types. But then many, many people also will say there are. So I'm a little confused by that a little bit.
Right.
Do you think that they exist? Like, is it useful for teachers to know the syllable types?
So I think it's useful for teachers to know that that's a concept that exists, right? Mm-hmm. So here's an example of how the idea of a syllable type is a problem. One question is how many syllable types are there, right? So people argue whether there are six of them or seven of them, right? Because there's the digraph syllable, right, which covers vowel teams, and then you have the diphthong syllable, which covers ow and oi, right? However, some people who tell you that don't acknowledge also that every long vowel is also a diphthong. Hmm. A, E, I, O, U, like they're diphthongs too, right? And so the E is really the only one that's not so much of a diphthong, but you know, the rest of them are diphthongs. And so if that's the case, then like, why are we calling them diphthong syllables also, right? We have this other category placement, which is a digraph category, which also doesn't really work because then we have things like IGH. And unless you're going to say the GH is silent and the I is an I by itself, which I wouldn't, I just put them all together and say it's one pattern. Well, that's not a digraph anymore. That's a trigraph. So mm-hmm. are we going to call that a trigraph syllable? You know, so it's like, I think the problem is that you end up with these increasingly complex sort of divisions and so on. English is what they call quasi-regular language, okay? There are lots of things in the phonic system in English that work well, okay? I mean, really, the consonants are easy to figure out most of the time, right? They're pretty predictable. Not all the time, but often the consonants are predictable. The vowels are less so, and that's what makes it more quasi-regular. So in English, everything is going to resist giving it like a, you know, it is always this sound. It is always, you know, this way. And so, and that's true of language in general. It's particularly true of English, like Finnish and Bosnian, like other languages, like they are really transparent. In Finnish, when the vowel is longer, they put two of it, right? Like two,
oh, nice.
You know, the word akoset, like it has, it says ah at the beginning. There are two A's to show it's not akoset, it's akoset, right? So, but, you know, we don't do that all the time. And it's just, it's a lot of it is just kind of historical. And so, I mean, I think it's helpful to understand the idea, but it's helpful to have a nuanced understanding too, which is that like, well, yes, those are diphthongs, but these other things are diphthongs too. And so I think generally my feeling is it's helpful for, I think it's even helpful for teachers to understand syllable division, even though I don't recommend teaching it because yeah. it's in the ether and there is, you know, some consistency to it in certain circumstances. So I don't think it's a bad thing to learn about.
Well, let's talk about that then. You know, an Orton-Gillingham type programs, there's very specific syllable division. Anyone listening that's familiar with those programs knows how those work, where you're, when I first started teaching first grade years ago, I was definitely a balanced literacy teacher. And the program I was given to teach was Saxon phonics. And I didn't like it. Now I didn't have any belief in explicit systematic phonics instruction. So I'm sure that definitely got in the way. But I was also overwhelmed at the time by the very, very exact syllable division strategy. And I thought, is this really worth our time? Like, this is so many steps. I wouldn't say it was as extreme in my Orton-Gillingham training, but there was a lot. And it took like 15 minutes of our lesson, you know, to look at just a few words. Let's label all the vowels. Let's look where they divide them. Let's label the syllable types. Now let's sound it out. Now, of course, we have to adjust it for the schwa or whatever. So they, like you said, they are extreme, and it is good for teachers to understand how words are split up, but maybe you can talk about, you've talked about percentages and how these aren't always very reliable. Maybe you can speak to that.
Yeah. So in terms of those division patterns, like they're, you know, the two kind of primary ones are the V, C, C, V, right? V, C, C, V, and that the vowel is divided between the consonants. The first syllable is closed, right? And the vowel is short, so it's a short sound. So that's pretty reliable, actually. So in the study that I did of this, it was 79% of the time that you divided a word with that pattern, it worked. 79% were all followed the rules. 15%, it was really just because it didn't, because of the schwa sound. So rather than saying the short sound said a schwa, it didn't even say like a long sound. So it didn't truly violate the rule. And then some other ones, it was something like the A says ah rather than saying A or A. Mm-hmm. So for the most part, the VCCV one works the way it should, says the short sound. The VCV one is not very reliable, particularly for the letters A and E. And so if you're trying to guess the pronunciation of a vowel letter or try to figure it out, and you do the V and the syllable CV, that does work more than half the time for A, I, O, and U. It does work more than half the time in two syllable words. It works less than half the time in with the letter E. That is when you get rid of the schwa as an option. So when you add in the schwa, none of them works more than half the time, right? And that's not true. For the U, it actually is pretty reliable. But the rest of the time, we don't know which it is, right? And that's with two syllable words. If you add in words with more than two syllables, it's an even bigger mess. And so basically, it turns out that for the VCV, it's really unreliable. It's very hard to tell what the pronunciation is going to be of that vowel before the consonant. And so it doesn't make a lot of sense to teach kids these really detailed rules because they don't work as well as we'd like them to, right? Again, I think teachers should understand that there, you know, there are these ways you can do these kinds of things. I think it's interesting. I know for me, when I had never been told, I didn't have Saxon Fox, I didn't have anything like that. We had literature works, and at least as far as I was concerned, it didn't. But I didn't, when I first learned about this, because I had Orton Gillingham type training, I was mad. I was like, why didn't anybody tell me this before, right? But then, you know, over time, just like you, I spent so much time doing it, and it was just like, it was really laborious. And I just thought, do we need to be doing this? And that's why I started to study it further and found that actually maybe not so much.
So I think that can be a little upsetting when teachers are here, okay, well, I finally had this thing that I think works, but it half the time or whatever, it doesn't work. So I have to tell the kids, well, sorry, it doesn't apply here. What hope do kids have? Like, what can they do?
Yeah. So two things about that. One is that I'm going to say something that like sounds really counterintuitive, is that it's possible that teaching them something that doesn't work that well is maybe not a bad idea, which sounds funny. So let me explain a little further. Now, this is particularly true, I think, for older children and for adults. I had this great quote from a paper in Annals of Dyslexia that involved an adult with dyslexia who basically had, the quote basically says that not until I learned syllable division was I able to read. That's basically the message from this adult, right? Really making a strong case that this stuff is essential. I think the idea is that even though like it may not work all the time, it gave this reader, this person, a way to get started, right? It gave them some confidence that there was something that they could do, right? And Edward Fry of the famous Fry Word List, right? He talked about some of these patterns that we teach kids as like they're tools just to get people started, right? So as long as you have some confidence that like you can figure it out, then you can start down that road, right? And so there's a reason to do that. And that's why I think teachers see benefits for kids. I think that's why teachers find that some kids like it, some kids respond to it, because it does give them confidence, right? And when you're teaching it, you give them lots of examples that do work, you know, especially to start, and then you give them the ones that are more complicated later. And so they can build some confidence that they can understand the system. Even though it doesn't work perfectly, it kind of like, you know, gets things going. And so so that's one thing. It's like, actually, there's a reason to say, like, in the end, it's not a terrible, terrible idea to do it. It's certainly better than a strategy that doesn't involve looking at the letters at all, which is what we, you know, the old like picture strategies and so on are involved. So I'm not going to say that syllable division has not helped children. I don't think that's true. I think it probably has helped a lot of kids. But I always say this, like, is it possible if you'd done something different, could the kids have done just as well or even better? And what I recommend is like a flexible division strategy that doesn't involve sort of the application of these very sort of strict rules, right? And it just gets you out of some tricky things. Like there are backup syllable division rules for all these things. It's like, so for like the word like chicken, like for chicken, well, it's a CK, so you have to divide it after the digraph. So it's like, now we have an extra thing we have to do, right? And if you don't have that rule, like literally kids can divide it after the CK if we don't have like a rule, right? And then as long as it like looks okay and they say chick and then end, that's fine. But if you don't sort of have that, then you have to sort of, there's a long list of things you have to add to it. And that's, again, just because English is quasi-regular. And so simpler is better. Also because it's faster and it's more likely to be something kids can do when they read.
So what would be one of those, how would you explain a flexible syllable division strategy?
Yeah, so the first thing I said already was they need to know, let's talk about like single letter vowels, right? So it's a little bit easier if it's not those. So if it has a single letter vowel, the first thing you do no matter what is to sort of, you can mark the vowels, so put a dot under the vowels. You don't need to put a V, right? I always try to think about what's the simplest way we can do this. And then mentally, once they have learned this, they can do it in their brain, but put a dot under the vowels, or sometimes if it's like a vowel team, I'll have the kids underline it, right? Mm-hmm. Or if it's a vowel R or something like that. So you mark the vowels, and then you know that you have to have at least one vowel in the syllable. So you divide it so that, you know, there's a vowel in each one. So then the idea is you divide it between the syllables, and there isn't a specific rule about how to do that. As long as like the parts look okay. So for example, yours describe, you can't do D-E-S-C-R, right? Because S-C-R doesn't occur at the end of a syllable, right? But it could be D-E-S and then C-R-I-B-E, right? Describe. Even though people say, no, it's describe. It really doesn't matter because it's the schwa anyway, actually. But you can break it up in various ways, and multiple of which are correct. And then if the result isn't a word, then you try it the other way. So a good example, like let's say it's the word, let's take the word major, for example, okay? So major, if you break it up after the J, and it is true, J doesn't occur at the end of syllables, but really, as long as it sort of works, it doesn't really matter, right? It can be flexible. So you have the J is at the end, now the A is in the middle, and we know if the vowel is in the middle, short sound, right? So it's, we can call it a short vowel syllable, or we just know, vowel in the middle, short sound. So that's madge. And then we take away the, if you use like a little card to divide it up, use your finger, and then take away the second part and you have or. So we now have madge or. We blend that together, major, madger, right? Because you have to turn the or into er, because that's the kind of the flexibility part of this too, is we have to have this kind of, you know, that's what phonological awareness is having the flexibility to turn it into the right, into like language that actually makes sense. And then you adjust that. And you say, okay, well, that didn't work. I need something else. That didn't work, meaning I didn't locate a word in my brain that sounds like that, right? So then I switch it. So now I cover up the J, and now it's M-A, major, 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 major. Yes, that's a word, and I can keep on going. So that would be the strategy would be to do something like that, right? And that does depend on knowing the word, right? That you're the target at the end, right? And if you don't know it, there are two things. One is when you're teaching kids phonics, it's a good idea for the most part, teach them words that they are a little bit familiar with. But the second thing is that if they don't know it and they do it and like their answer is wrong, but they don't have to say it to anybody else, it's a brand new word to them, like a name or something. It doesn't actually matter if they say it wrong in their brain because there's nobody else to say it to anyway, right? The only problem is it can result in some embarrassment when you say it one way in your brain and then later you're like, you say it out loud and everyone's like, no, it's not Yosemite National Park, actually. Yes. But besides those situations, you know, you should always be kind of linking to the lexicon, finding a word in your brain that it's linked to. So that's the strategy, and it's much simpler and something you can use easily as you're reading.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of a hard thing to accept. I think that that they can't always land on the right word unless they've actually heard it before, but that's true with both ways, right? That's true with the syllable division, the very picky syllable division, and the more flexible, like you said. And so that of course points out to the importance of reading aloud to kids and getting them familiar with as many words as we can. Yeah. Do you recommend like for, let's say, a first, second grade teacher, or maybe a late first grade teacher who's teaching kids to read polysyllabic words, do you recommend like making that a specific part of their phonics lesson for a certain amount of time every day, and you just have a list of words that you practice with?
Yeah, I always kind of just depends, right? But sure. I mean, I think that like kids need strategies for reading long words, right? The reason that I started studying it was because nobody did it at the time. And so, yeah, I think that giving kids time on those kind of strategies is a good idea. Once they've gotten down a lot of the kind of fundamental concepts about monosyllabic words, right? You know, you can have kids practice with, you know, polysyllabic words, even if you aren't teaching strategies for reading them, right? You know, I know there are certain Orton-Gillingham-based programs that do that, even before they've taught syllable division and all that. They'll, you know, they'll teach things as though there are kind of two syllables, like, you know, word, like Wisconsin, right? Mm-hmm. All, you know, you can, even without dividing it up, you can see there are three.
Sure.
You know,
so starting syllables with those more regular ones.
Yeah, exactly.
The predictable.
Simply, you can look at the parts or whatever, simply. But you can, you know, but building in opportunities to practice reading words like that is a good idea. The more strategy they have to read long words, the better, especially after first grade, because basically once you hit grade two, Almost all the new words kids learn have more than one syllable. They've learned most, like more than half of them. Yeah. They'll learn have more than one syllable.
I can't remember. I think it was from Louise Spear Swirling. I think it was from her where she talked about how when you decide to teach your students some kind of syllable division strategy, like the one you said, even simple with the dots and the lines, that it might be like 4 to 6 weeks of like 10 minutes a day or something like that to help until they internalize it. And that's like what you said. That's the point, right? So that when they get to longer words, they don't necessarily have to get out their pencil and mark it up, but they've seen that words are predictable and that there's a pattern in there. It's not just something they have to just guess at.
You got it.
So maybe we can close out with really quick talking about morphology a little bit. I think you've written about that as well. And does that help kids with learning disabilities learn to read longer words? And if it does, how should that instruction be carried out?
So morphology is really valuable for teaching kids with reading difficulty. In one of my first big studies, that one I mentioned before, I decided to compete morphology against letter sounds, right? So I thought really the power and instruction of the letter sounds. And if you look at the way kids process words, we're going to find that they're tuning into the consistencies of the letter sounds, right? And so my study was to ask, like, if kids know all the letter sounds in these words, can they read them? Versus if they know all the morphemes in the words, can they read them, right? And I was convinced it was going to be the letter sounds that mattered. And it wasn't true. It was really the morphemes that made a difference. If the kids could read the morphemes, they could then read the whole word. Which in retrospect is pretty obvious, right? Because morphemes are bigger pieces. They're bigger mm-hmm. chunks, right? And that's what makes them powerful, is that they give kids a bigger chunk of letters that they can use. So it actually helps break up the word a little bit more easily, because you don't have as many little pieces you have to break it into. And you can give students strategies that allow them to do that. And so many polysyllabic words are also polymorphemic that it actually can reduce the size of the reading problem dramatically. If you think about one of those made up long words like anti-disestablishmentarianism, right? It's actually not that hard to read if you find all the affixes, and most of the parts of the word are affixes. And so, mm-hmm. so if you can give kids a strategy to do that, it actually reduces the size of the reading problem. And, you know, for some kids with really severe reading difficulty, some of the phonological practice that we give them is very hard for them and doesn't seem to get easier very quickly. And so for those kids, having a strategy that allows them to think in bigger chunks so that they don't have to do as much phonological manipulation, that's a really, really good thing. And so really teaching kids affixes, like to pronounce them and know what they are, but particularly for the purpose of phonics, knowing how to pronounce them, right? And then recognizing them in words, finding them. Some programs where kids circle them, I think that's a fine idea. And then you can break it apart and you can get like the base or the root, the base or the root word or the root, whatever terminology you want to use, depending on what it is. Like root would be not a word, like odd and audible or whatever, base word being an actual word, whatever. You get down to that base word or that root, and then you can build it back together, right? So odd, and then it will all audible, and so on. And so that would be the strategy that would be really helpful for students, is to do that. And some people have done kind of like language play kind of things where you can add on and take off different affixes. Mm-hmm. And that's in some programs too. And so those kinds of strategies where you basically can look at affixes and then sometimes manipulate those, that can be really helpful. But really the key is to help kids identify affixes and then use those to kind of peel them off. There's a strategy called peeling off, peel them off of the word, find that base, and then put it back together. That can be really helpful for kids with phonological processing difficulty.
Yeah, I was just going to mention that because I remember reading that and maybe it was in one of your articles, but the peeling off idea. And also it takes that attention away from having to label each section, right? Like, so AUD, you wouldn't have to look at that as a diphthong syllable or whatever you'd call it. It's just the root that you've learned to read. And by that point, they should be able to do that. Is there anything else that you'd like to share before we go? Talk about Finder or anything else or any projects you're working on?
Since you mentioned Finder, I'll talk about it. So I created a website really long time ago now where people can go to find words for phonics lessons. So if you're trying to remember AI words, and you're saying, I cannot think of a single AI word right now, even though I have to teach a lesson on tomorrow. And this is what happened to me, like, because when I taught at a clinic, like I was, their lessons were, their tutoring lessons for kids one-on-one. And so I was always like, doing AI tomorrow, I can't think of words. So I made this website to help people do that. So it's pretty helpful. Actually, I I at one point of pride is that you fly, which most people know now, that email, they actually use Finder to find a bunch of the words in you fly.
That's
so
great.
So that's one thing. The other thing I want to say is, you know, and all the syllable stuff, it's gotten a little heated, right? But I want to make sure that it's clear. A few things are clear. One, we are on the same side. So the people who are like upset with me about this, we're on the same side. I believe in systematic explicit phonics instruction to a really great degree. The reason that I am making these points about syllables is not because I want to give anybody a hard time. It's not because I would really like to not have to tell, you know, say anything about Orton-Gillingham programs. It's not positive because it's so much better than the alternative, right? Data don't tell us, don't support every single thing about these programs, right? It is absolutely the case that things are evidence-based on the whole, and they are. Several Orton-Gillingham programs have positive effects. That's been shown to be true over multiple studies, right? Orton-Gillingham as an approach has decent effects overall, right? Like they're not dramatic, but I think probably because it's hard to write your own program, which is kind of what we have to do. But I think, you know, like in general, those programs are not bad, but they have in them some strategies, and this one is a pretty big piece of it, but it is important to know, like, it doesn't have a great evidence base. And I didn't decide to do this because I wanted to make it difficult. I just wanted to think about whether or not this is actually worthwhile. What I want to kind of put to the folks who sort of disagree about this is that everyone sort of are, you know, I think on that team, so to speak, believes in the science of reading. At least we say we believe in the science of reading, right? That's the moment we're in, is the science of reading, right? People say, I believe in the science of reading. And a lot of those same people are people who teach syllable division. I also believe in the science of reading. But if we're going to believe in the science, we have to be scientific about it, which is to say that if the science doesn't take us in the direction that we want to go, then we have to challenge our preconceptions and basically say, like, actually, you know what? Like, that is not strongly supported by science, right? And so that we're willing to accept new information and challenge our own beliefs. Because if we don't do that, then we're going to kind of, quote, lose in the science of reading kind of debate, right? People who sort of the antagonists in this, right? It's easy to poke holes in the, quote, science of reading if it's evident that science of reading people are not being scientific, right? And that's the danger we face, is that people aren't willing to face their own preconceptions and sort of accept that, like, maybe they're not right. And if that doesn't happen, then we're easy targets. And so that's why I started doing this, was because I don't want to be that person. I don't want to be sort of stuck in a situation where I'm having to say to myself, like, I'm basically kind of lying to myself in order to support a viewpoint. And I think I just want to actually make a plea to people who don't agree about this stuff to think about the idea that we need to think scientifically. I don't think all of the evidence is against syllable division. And again, as I said, these Orton-Gillingham-based programs have positive evidence. So I don't want to say that they don't. But I just want to challenge people to think about, if you want to win the science of reading war,
then
talk about science and believe in science.
Yeah, and also just teachers don't have to feel like, even though they might appreciate a particular program, they don't have to be convinced that every single piece of that program is the best way. There's other things to look into, and not every piece of any program works for every child. So we can start in the same understanding that we need systematic explicit phonics instruction, but how to carry that out can look different depending on who you're working with. Well, thank you so much. Are there any other future projects you're willing to share, or are those?
Well, right now I'm doing a lot of work with schools and teachers on data-based decision-making, actually.
Oh, yeah.
So how to help teachers make really good decisions about what individual kids need. So to your last point, not everything works for every kid. And so actually in this project, what we do is we tell teachers, start with a program and teach it with fidelity. And that means that if it's an Orton-Gillingham-based program that involves syllable division, actually say, do it as designed, right? Like, because these programs do have evidence. And then we evaluate the data. Every 6 weeks, we come together after teachers have collected weekly progress monitoring data, and we look at student performance. And then what we do is we make adaptations. We actually change the program. But we're not doing it just because, you know, like, we think it's a good idea. Mm-hmm. We do it systematically based on data. And it's a big gear shift for teachers to, like, basically say, hold off, don't make changes yet. Look at the data and look at those data regularly. And so we're teaching teachers how to do that. And it's really exciting. It's a lot of fun for me because So we're teaching teachers how to do this at schools. I just love to go and like listen to, you know, teachers talk about their kids and look at the data for the kids and figure out like what can we do to help this kid better, right? It's really fun to do. It's so much work for people to figure out, but we've created some tools to make it easier for people. So our project is running right now just in Connecticut. So if, okay. We have Connecticut colleagues, we're looking for partners for our next year's project. Soon we'll have a website and freely available tools.
Ooh, exciting.
We'll do that. So that's really exciting coming up. But yeah, so it's kind of going beyond just the program itself and into how do we make adaptations. And I really like that work.
That's wonderful. And that's what teachers really need help with these days is figuring out what to do with the data and how to help students. All right. Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate talking to you.
Yeah, it was really fun. Thanks for giving me the opportunity to share these things and asking these really good questions. And I hope that people come back and ask you questions and email me questions too. And I want to continue the conversation. We're all hopefully on similar sides, so I want to meet people where they are.
Awesome. Thank you.
All right.
You can find the show notes for today's episode, including a link to Dr. Curran's program Finder, at themeasuredmom.com/episode165. Talk to you next time.
That's all for this episode of Triple R Teaching. For more educational resources, visit Anna at her home base, themeasuredmom.com, and join our teaching community. We look forward to helping you reflect, refine, and recharge on the next episode of Triple R Teaching.